the relationship with a therapist is a relationship like any other relationship. It involves work. It takes work, right? A back and forth. And practicing, for a lot of my clients, practicing that narrative or practicing the speaking up for themselves and sharing their feelings is therapeutic in itself.
Hello folks, welcome back to Two Suitcases. For this first episode of our second season, Raksha and I wanted to unpack a topic that is rarely acknowledged, let alone embraced, in many immigrant communities: mental health. In today's episode, we speak with Dr. Shanta Kanukolu, who is a psychologist practicing in Chicago who primarily focuses on the South Asian community. We ask her about her journey in becoming a therapist, providing mental health services in the South Asian context, and some of the ways we can better advocate for mental health awareness in immigrant families and communities. Here's our conversation with Dr. Shanta Kanukolu. Shanta, we're really happy to have you on the show today, and we're really excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. So excited to be here with you both.
What is your story and your background? It feels like there's not a lot of South Asian folks who venture into mental health as a profession. How did that all work out for you? Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I will say that the story now, the landscape seems to be really changing in regards to that, which is so exciting and surprising and awesome to see so many more South Asian folks now coming into the field. But yes, when I started into the field, it was a little different. I'm first generation in my family to be born in the US. My parents immigrated to New Jersey from India in the 70s. And I was raised in New Jersey and spent most of my young adulthood there on the East Coast. I went to Rutgers University for my undergraduate career. And then I did some research at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City prior to going to graduate school at University of Michigan. And I'm specifically from Edison, which many of you might know to be the Little India of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And what I found was back then, despite being surrounded by so many Asian American families and so many South Asian American families, there was very little conversation I found at the time in my community, amongst my friends, my parents' friends, about mental health, right? And the possibility of this being a career option. And so I started off as a pre-med student, as many of us South Asian folks are prone to do. Not because there was pressure or anything like that, but because I just felt like an obvious choice. It felt like what was in my surroundings. I felt like I was a pretty good student and I would excel in that area. And what I was surprised about was that I found myself not enjoying it and not being passionate about it, and struggled a bit to figure out what my next steps were. I found my peers were really excited about the topic and far more motivated than I was. And so I started taking some psychology courses and really fell in love with it, and especially found myself really intrigued by the fact that cultural factors were missing and cultural differences were missing in those conversations in my courses. And so couldn't stop pursuing it and wanted to explore and dig some more into it. And here I am after all those classes and all those years of school.
You know, I can completely relate to the pre-med route in some ways, or in my case, engineering. The option is either you become a doctor or an engineer, but you know, it's exciting to hear that you kind of stepped away from that and you did what you wanted to do, because I ended up falling into that cattle of people kind of going into the engineering route and then later on realizing that, hey, maybe this is really not for me.
Yeah. And Raksha, I know you had a tough time kind of balancing that and bringing up with your dad and with your family that, you know, maybe there's another option besides engineering. And there was a lot of pushback for that, like this tends to be in a lot of our immigrant communities. So Shanta, did you have similar kind of pushback from either your community or your family to go down this path?
Yeah, I think more than pushback, there was a lot of confusion and discomfort. They were very excited once they found that I was pursuing jobs and research opportunities. And they found like, okay, she has some consistency. This isn't just a fleeting thing. I think that was helpful for them to realize I was certain about it. And they saw my grades improved, my energy improved, my motivation improved. I wasn't really who I was at the beginning there of college. I wasn't aligned with myself, my values. And so I think over time, there was some appreciation for that. But I think there was certainly some discomfort, right? Because it was confusing to for people to know what to ask. Like, you know, right. I think I found myself, for example, at family parties. And when I was with my cohort, my friends who I grew up with, no one was doing this intentionally or to be mean or to be, you know, discounting who I was. But it was interesting to notice and hard and difficult to notice that they would say, what are you doing in school? What are you doing in school? You know, what school, college are you going to? And they could relate or they could talk more about medicine, right? Or, or law or engineering. Right. Oh, I know so-and-so did this. Or, oh, you should talk to my son. They did this too, right? But I would say I'm doing psychology, silence, right? Cricket.
Yeah.
Again, not because people were trying to mean, but they didn't know what more to ask.
Right.
You know what more to say? It was new. And I remember specifically an uncle saying to me, he said, I remember I was very excited telling him, I'm looking at the differences in treatment for how it affects different communities or how what the outcomes are for, at the time I was doing research on substance abuse treatment for African-American versus Caucasian-American clients at the time, right? And so I was just talking about how, you know, I want to know culturally what are the things that maybe South Asian folks will need when they're in treatment. And he said, but Nishi or Shanta, I go by both names, that doesn't happen in our community. We don't have those things. We don't have those problems, right? And right there, I think that encompassed how it felt, right? That people were very warm and giving and kind in the community I grew up with. But there was disconnection from the topic. There was lack of belief that it was something valuable in our community. Mm-hmm. I think there might have been maybe so-and-so they knew who was depressed or so-and-so who knew that was something's up with them. Right. But the language and the dialogue and the understanding of what that meant, right, was lacking.
Mm-hmm. So you eventually went and pursued your doctorate in Michigan, and that's led you to where you are now. Could you tell us a little bit more about your practice and, you know, what spaces you've worked in mental health?
Sure. So I got my degree in clinical psychology and women's studies from the University of Michigan. And my main interest was focusing on South Asian mental health during my graduate studies. It was an area that was just starting to grow. There, I found there were a lot more research studies, a lot more work back then on East Asian families and communities, or South Asians were really lumped into this Asian American big group, right? Mm-hmm. And I found myself really wondering, again, that's a huge step. It was going from not including Asian Americans to now including Asian Americans in the studies. But I still found, wow, we're lumping a lot of people from a really big continent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With very different immigration contexts and stories into a study, right?
Right.
So I found that to be problematic. And so it was great to work at University of Michigan with my professor, Dr. Ramaswamy Mahalingam, who gave me the space to think through these topics and talk about it with him. I still found after graduating, however, there weren't many spaces where I could work with South Asians in the workplace, right? Yeah. The clients are not there. Mm-hmm. And so my passion really fell under the umbrella of mental health outcomes, mental health issues in ethnic minority communities. And I had a specific interest in trauma. And so that led me to work in places like Cook County Jail here in Chicago, which was a really, really fascinating and important job for me at the time. I worked with women who were in a program that provided treatment while they were incarcerated. I had a trauma lens to it, which I really appreciated. I then moved on to Lake County Jail and Probation here in Illinois, similarly working for a court system that provided treatment for substance abuse and trauma, and not just, you know, incarceration. The idea being we have to provide treatment for people, otherwise they're going to be in these cycles of exiting jail.
Right.
Back, right. There's no, if you don't give job training or treatment or support, what do we expect? Right? We expect people to come right back. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot in those spaces, really valuable experiences. And I got to work with a population I was passionate about, right? Ethnic minority communities.
Right.
Unfortunately, are disproportionately represented in the jail system here, right? With histories of trauma. And then I worked at a veterans hospital here, the Heinz Veterans Hospital here in Chicago. So again, working with adults with trauma histories, very valuable as well. I had never worked with that population before. And really, you know, being born and raised in America, not having people who are servicemen or women in my family or my community that I knew of, it was truly a culturally important experience to work with veterans and learn more about topics and conversations that I hadn't had before. And then I became a mom and found myself really wanting to start to focus my time on what I went to graduate school for, which was working with South Asian folks. And so I took a leap to open my own private practice, and that's where I am now. And the private practice world has given me flexibility to be a mom and to have that flexibility as a mother to negotiate both identities, right? And it's given me the chance to work with the population that I've been really interested in working with for over a decade, right?
Yeah.
So my practice is in downtown Chicago, of course, mostly telehealth at this time with COVID. But I would say over 50% of my clients are South Asian Americans, and it's been really rewarding work.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That just sounds really fascinating. I mean, listening to your whole journey, right? I mean, starting from working in the jail system to veterans and now finally doing what you wanted to do all along. As South Asians ourselves, I know Barth and I, we've always talked about therapy and going to a therapist and how our community looks at it. If I'm looking for a therapist, I'm usually saying, who would understand what, you know, what are my needs? Can they satisfy what I'm looking for? Because are they going to understand the background that I come from? And going to someone with the same or similar background just feels more comforting. And so it's exciting to hear that there a lot of people are seeking therapy now and are open to it, because I don't think any of my friends, we openly talk about it. No one really talks about going to therapy, or it's not an open dialogue until like one time I was like, yeah, I think I would be interested. And someone was like, really? Do you really need therapy? Yeah. And so it's still kind of a shy topic. No one really goes into it. So it's very exciting for me to know that there is a space for us to reach out to someone similar to us, you know?
Yeah. And Raksha, what you were saying about it being an easier thing to kind of talk about now, I was just thinking about it. Friends probably that I made in high school or right at the beginning of college, it's harder to talk about mental health with them. But folks that I met, you know, more recently, when you're kind of just building that friendship, you can kind of be more open, and you kind of can just gauge over like 6-7 years how much that's transitioned into being able to speak more openly about seeking help, about just mental health services in general.
You kind of nailed it, Barth. Actually, it's same thing.
Yeah.
If I look back, I don't think I can have this conversation with my friends in college, but people now in my adult circle or older, I can tell them, hey, I see a therapist, and I don't think there's going to be any judgment cast on that, because you're always fearing the judgment for some reason.
Right. Switching gears a little bit, one of the things that Raksha and I have had conversations over and had to do some research on, but always felt like there was too much information out there to really kind of synthesize, is what kind of mental health professionals or what kind of mental health services are out there? And in what situations do you go seek a particular professional in the mental health space?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I think this is a question I get a lot. And from people who are not just South Asian, right? Which speaks to some sort of, I don't know, I think a gap in the system that even the most, with the most internet access and, you know, phone access and education, these roles of different types of mental health professionals are still in a black box, right? And more so than, of course, if you add this to a community that doesn't talk about mental health traditionally, right?
Right.
There's lots of mystery, confusion, and intrigue about what this even means. What is therapy, right?
Right.
And so I've been trying, it's funny you mentioned this, I've been thinking a lot about doing workshops. I've done a few on this about just therapy 101, right? About what is a therapist? What should therapy feel like? What should you look for in a therapist? Does insurance cover it? Can my employer see my diagnoses? There's all sorts of myths about it. And I love doing these workshops because you just realize there's not many outlets where people can ask these questions, right? So yes, there are a lot of different types of mental health professionals, and people can seek mental health professions for a variety of reasons, right? I liken it to exercising, right? There is yoga, there's Pilates, there's weight training, there's Peloton, SoulCycle. There are different types of exercise. Mm-hmm. You have to find the one that fits your needs and makes you feel good and is a match with who you are, right? They all might be doing similar things, getting you in shape, making you feel healthier, making you, endorphins, course through your body. But we have to find the one that fits us, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it means having to try different professionals, working with different professionals to see what that feels like and see which style you like better, which I know can take a lot of work. But I, for example, give people, and I know a lot of my colleagues do this, give 15-minute phone consultations to people when they're interested in working with me, just to chat, to see, are we a good fit, right? Like, how's our conversation going? What are things that are important to you? And so I'd recommend that people do that and not give up if they have a mismatch the first time, right? Again, if someone said I worked out once and never going to work out again, we'd say, oh, come on, you got to work out, right?
Right.
Similarly, if you're working on your mind and working on your psyche and working on your old patterns and histories and you need to, make some shifts and evolve, we can't give up after one session and say it didn't work for me, right? And so the different types of professionals, there's so many, but I will start with some of the main ones. So a psychiatrist, that's someone who is a licensed medical doctor, is someone who has completed psychiatric training. They can diagnose mental health conditions and they can prescribe and monitor medications and often provide therapy as well. Some have completed additional training and maybe child and adolescent mental health, substance use disorders, or geriatric psychiatry. And again, what you're looking at there is people who are medically trained and they do have the ability to prescribe medication.
And when do you know you need to take medication? I mean,
will
a therapist just gauge that and say you might need to go to a psychiatrist? Am I saying that right?
How I do like that avenue best, working with a psychotherapist who, again, the license, I'll go into that in a minute, can be a variety of different degrees or backgrounds or trainings. But I do like and value when someone is already engaged in psychotherapy and has a trusted relationship there. And then they're also supplementing that with medication if that's what is being recommended to them. I'm saying all this, but I think it's hard to generalize because there are some people, however, who are in a crisis and have been in a crisis for many years and have just managed their symptoms. People who have schizophrenia, people who have bipolar disorder, suicidal thoughts, homicidal thoughts. In those situations, right, talk therapy is not going to be enough. We need to also make sure there is psychiatric support immediately to ensure the person is safe and stable, right? So it depends on the presenting issue, right? But I think the best approach, generally speaking, I think, is when talk therapy and medication are happening together, because the medication will handle the biological pieces of it, physiological pieces of it, right? Some of this is genetic too. Families have histories of things, and especially as South Asians, oftentimes have families that have psychiatric disorders or diagnoses, but we have no idea.
Right, yeah.
So it's important to get evaluated if there are some symptoms that have been problematic and see if you need talk therapy and or medication.
So is talk therapy usually a good kind of entry point into seeking mental health services? Is that kind of a good way to channel you to other specialists that you might need to see?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think some people do it the other way. They'll say, no, I want to talk to a psychiatrist. I want a medical doctor.
Okay.
I want to talk to them and ask them what they think. Some people do it the other way around. They're like, I'm a little shy about medication. I really want to make sure medication's for me. I have a lot of assumptions, biases, fears about medication, right?
Yeah.
So I think it can go either way, but I always recommend asking the provider about these avenues. Because we never want to be over-medicated and over-diagnosed, but we also don't want to be under-medicated and under-diagnosed, right?
Right.
By having that team or having that open dialogue with your professional provider is really important. And being honest with them about your symptoms and then getting their feedback. And hopefully your professional that you trust will be able to say, yeah, I think you can try it, or, up to you. Let's, here are some possible medications. But let's see how it goes. Or some might say, yeah, I think you've been struggling with this for a very long time. And I think medication is going to be necessary for you to even listen and take in what's happening and talk
to them.
If someone's struggling with ADHD, for example, right, or is so depressed, like talk therapy can't make a dent, right, in what's happening. It might be the other way around. You need medication to just get your symptoms from 0 to 10. If they're at a high pitch 10, severe 10, getting it down even to a 7 can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm back to what I was saying. So there's psychiatrists, then there's psychologists like myself. We hold doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, and that can be a PhD or a PsyD, or another specialty such as counseling or education. They're trained to evaluate a person's mental health using clinical interviews, evaluations, testing, and we can make diagnoses and provide individual or group therapy or family therapy, depending on our specialization. So those are psychologists. And then there are counselors, clinicians, therapists. They're used synonymously with psychologists sometimes, but they're not the same, just due to differences in educational training, years of training. They're usually master's level clinicians. They have different licensing boards than us as psychologists or psychiatrists. There may be similarities in how they do therapy based on how they were trained. So it's really important to not just judge by degree. It really depends on who trained them, how they orient themselves. I personally think I carry a bit of a social work / counseling / social justice feminist approach to therapy, right? But that's not the case for all psychologists. So you want to ask people what their training is in.
Are social workers, do they tend to be licensed professionals as well, or is it a separate training altogether?
Yes, I was going to, that was my next little bullet point. So social workers, if they have LCSWs, they are licensed clinical social workers. They're also LPCs, who are licensed professional counselors. There's LMFTs, as licensed marriage and family therapists. There's also LCADACs, that are licensed clinical alcohol and drug abuse counselors. So they're all wonderful professions, all very, can be all competent therapists. But again, there are going to be just differences in training and orientation to how they approach therapy.
Just to throw out a scenario to you, right? Like, let's think about the population that usually listens to our podcast. Young adults like Barth and I, you know, we just have day-to-day trouble. For example, I feel really anxious at work and I feel really stressed out. And you could also tie back, maybe I think I have some childhood trauma, and that's why it's kind of leading into the way I am reacting to certain things. So that's, I'm sitting with all that information. And now, where do I start? Do I go to a social worker, or would I come to a psychologist? And the level of care, would there be a difference?
Yeah, that's hard to say, because I think I know people with all of these degrees who are amazing professionals and amazing clinicians, right? It's such an individual experience, right? For what'll be the right fit for you, which makes it hard. But I think the same could be said, again, this is very different. I realize this might be like a, not a wonderful parallel, but I think about how, whether it's your dentist, your gynecologist, your primary care physician, your hairdresser, your people who are supporting you and caring for you, might not be the fit for everyone.
Right.
You're going to have to find the one that fits you. But I think that's why having that initial conversation with them, seeing what their specialty areas are, is really important. So if you go to their website and you'll read their, oftentimes there's a profile or a little bit about their background and then areas of expertise, our specialty populations or favorite populations or clinical interests or research articles that they've written, you can look at that and get a feel for what's the area of interest for these people, right? Do I want to be in a room with them? Some people have, you know, looked at my profile and said, oh, I just really love that you said South Asian a lot on your profile. Someone else who's South Asian can be turned off by that, by the way.
Said,
I don't identify with that so much. I don't want to be lumped into that category. And I don't want to talk to you because you remind me of some auntie.
Yeah.
Right? Or you remind me of my older sister. And I really don't want to be judged as like what type of Indian I am or what type of South Asian I am.
Right.
And that's interesting. Raksha and I have had conversations where, you know, growing up outside of India and then moving to another place that's not India, she's had a different experience than me in the sense that she's tended to gravitate to at least have an easier time interacting with Indians. Whereas for me, there's that always that sense of, okay, I'm not really Indian and I don't want to be lumped in that category. So it's, you know, up until college, I would actively avoid, you know, associating in those spaces. So it's interesting that you say that because, yeah, not everyone just jumps at, oh, South Asian, that's who I want to go talk to just because I'm South Asian as well. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting point.
That's why it can't be one size fits all, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we know research shows that ethnic match doesn't guarantee a better clinical outcome.
Okay.
Ethnic match doesn't necessarily, it really is a number of factors. Mm-hmm. I think for some, it is a must and is going to help facilitate vulnerability, honesty, good rapport, and a good interpersonal dynamic. And for others, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 So, you know, something that we are kind of intrigued and want to know a little bit more. So as a mental health provider, you know, what challenges do you usually face when it comes to people of color or immigrants?
Yeah, I think there's some themes. Of course, this differs by person, by family, by community. So when I'm saying this, I also recognize that this is not the case for everybody. So I don't want to make, you know, add to the stereotypes or generalizations, but there are some themes that I've noticed in my patients. So one thing I've noticed is there's often confusion about how therapy works and what it actually is. Right. Okay. And so back to that basics of what is therapy? Who do I talk to for therapists? How do I find a therapist? But then once they found a therapist, when they're in the room, they're not quite sure how this works. Right. There is sometimes this frustration that therapy is not helping fast enough. Right. That it's not, I'm not giving them answers or solutions. Right. Which, in my opinion, is not what therapy is. Right. Therapy is really tapping into one's own wisdom, I think, and helping them figure out what works best for them, right? Because they're going to have to figure out their values and their histories and their dynamics to figure out what they feel most confident doing, right? Or saying in situations they're bringing in. And so I've found sometimes there's frustration with the process. And then when that happens, there often is a difficulty. And a lot of my friends and even people who've called me and asked me about therapy, they're really surprised when I say this last part that I say when they come and say, what do I do? My therapist and I, like, oh, something seems off. I'll say, did you talk to them? And they'll say, whoa, that's awkward. That's really awkward.
I can't. Yeah.
Right? Like, ooh, what do we want to say? Like, you suck? What do I say? You're racist?
Yeah.
And I'll say, tell them exactly what you just told me. You did not like how that last session went because ... You feel like when you're in the room, it feels like ... right? I felt upset when you made a generalization about Indian people. I felt upset when you angry when you gave me this feedback that felt too much for me at the time, like saying it out loud. And I say that because the relationship with a therapist is a relationship like any other relationship. It involves work. Right. It takes work, right? A back and forth. And practicing for a lot of my clients, practicing that narrative or practicing the speaking up for themselves and sharing their feelings is therapeutic in itself. That's something they've never been encouraged to do. That's something that they've never had the space to do because they have to respect their elders or respect their teachers or respect Dr. Saab or whoever, right? It's like, ooh, you don't say that. But it's important that therapy feels comfortable. And if it doesn't, please share that with your therapist so they can help you work through whatever it is that's going on in the room between the two of you. So that's one theme. The other theme is guilt / shame / secrecy about being in therapy.
Right.
That is, there's so many offshoots to that, right? So there's guilt, for example, that they've had a quote unquote good life. So why are they in therapy? Guilt that they aren't African-American or Black. So they shouldn't complain about racism or struggles they have at work around discrimination because they are right? This is a whole other topic.
All right.
They don't have it that bad. Secrecy from, you know, about being in therapy from their family. Things like, I can't tell them, they won't understand. Yeah. Or they'll make me feel bad for being in therapy. They'll say, what have I done wrong?
Right.
Yeah. Or, oh, you know, I've heard this many times. They'll ask, what's so bad in your life that you have to talk to someone else about it outside of our home?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Heard that one.
Or, it's because you stopped praying and going to temple.
You heard that one a lot. Heard that one so much.
are you sure your partner's okay with that? Because they might leave you if they know you're going to therapy. Right. So this idea, again, all of these are just examples of this notion that we have to be ashamed or feel guilty or do this in secrecy or else.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And I think we've seen this. I've seen t-shirts with this now, sweatshirts about this. I've seen the Hasan Minhaj, you know, stand up about, you know, we know this term in Hindi, people say it, lo kya kahenge. Mm-hmm. What do people say? Which is another way of then bringing about secrecy, shame, guilt, right? About being these places. There's also themes related to gender, I will say. Mm-hmm. We know that experiences and how South Asian women and men, girls and boys are raised, often there's differences there. So there is shame, you know, in for men who say, I should be stronger than this. I'm a little embarrassed that I'm here.
Yeah.
Or I'm a male physician. It's kind of embarrassing that I have to come to therapy. Like I look so weak, right?
Yeah.
There isn't room for vulnerability
for
many men. For women too, but I would say that we forget too sort of the masks and the expectations that are put upon men to be strong, to be, you know, the strong one that everyone leans on in the home or whatever might be the case. My feedback always is, what if we looked at vulnerability as something very brave and very courageous and very powerful and deep that will change generations after you about how they'll talk about emotions and look to you for advice?
Mm. Wow.
For women, there's the expectation I hear a lot, the struggle about being single at a specific age, expectation for men and women to be married to a specific kind of person. There's also then, I think, for males and females in different ways, the ambivalence between carving their own path and staying close to home out of respect and duty. Yeah. Right? So many will say, I really want to move away, but I can't, I'm the oldest, or I can't, I'm like my mom's only son, or like, I can't, I feel really bad about wanting to move away. They'll think I'm betraying them, or my grandfather's sick. How could I just up and leave? Right. So this ambivalence of like, I really want to do something.
Yeah.
But how do I initiate this now as an adult when I'm an adult, but I feel like a kid.
Right.
Really confusing for me. Right.
Right. I think for Raksha and I, it's kind of almost the opposite. It's like, go, go, go. There's nothing in Zambia for you guys to do. Stop wasting the opportunity. Like, you know, you guys have gone and studied in the West. Like, take advantage of that. You know, don't come back here. Like, you know, we're okay. There's nothing else for you to pursue here. I think it's kind of the reverse of that. But it's interesting you bring that up.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I think.
And when you have it opposite, it's kind of like, well, I do want to go back home and be close to our parents because you've lived so many years away from them.
Yeah.
I mean, half my life at this point.
Yeah.
Right. And missed out on birthdays and anniversaries and so many other things.
Yeah. Right.
So, but the guilt of not wanting to go, the guilt of wanting to make it happen here and be successful here stops you from turning back and saying, screw all of this. I just want to go back home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, we don't have that option.
Right.
We do, but we don't, you know?
Yeah,
you're right. There's a tension. I think we can look at it from either side of the coin, but there's a tension in both areas, right? Of what it means to be displaced from a country of origin and what pressures come with that and what expectations come with that, either from within ourselves or from others around us.
Yeah. So Shanta, did you have any, I guess when you started eventually your own practice, did you have a challenge attracting South Asian patients to seek therapy, or did you feel like that was almost a vacuum that was just waiting to be filled?
I was really surprised that by the time I opened my private practice, it was a vacuum waiting to be filled. Mm. I was really, really surprised. I was almost in tears. I was just in shock that my first client called me and just, I put up my website and what I specifically came to the field for, specifically to talk about sexual trauma, which is another thing I was going to add, another theme that Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see across ethnic minority communities, but especially in the South Asian community, I won't say more so or less so, is silence around matters around abuse, sexual abuse, or other challenging or stigmatized topics, right? Like, I think recently there's more talk about depression and anxiety in the community, but it's not as sexy to talk about child sexual abuse, domestic violence, physical abuse, heroin use, miscarriage, infertility, right? So I think that's another theme, is that there's some areas of mental health that are seemingly okay and more okay to talk about and cool to talk about. And there's others that are, you know, still very uncomfortable and very, there's a lot of awkwardness around that piece of it. So that's another theme I've noticed. But sorry, to go back to your question about the vacuum. Yeah, I think there was a vacuum, and I was really surprised to see that. And I still see it. There's still people on my wait list who really want to work with me, work with a South Asian therapist, and I try to refer them to somebody else, and then they're full still too. Yeah. So there's clearly a need.
Yeah. As you were going through all of the, you know, the challenges that as people of color or generally people that come to you are facing, it, in a weird way, made me smile, because I'm like, finally, you know, these are real topics that people are going through, and we're not talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's always in a closed room. You know, there were some topics that you brought up really resonated with me, but I don't think I could even say it out loud that I feel those things, because how can I? You know, my life is pretty perfect, you know, or pretty normal to other people. But internally, there's a lot of conflict and a lot of questions that you have, but we can't have these conversations openly. And that's the scary part. And for me, I think that's where I think a therapist will provide that safe space, is how I see it. And when I go to see a therapist, you know, the one topic that comes to my mind is, how do you have your sessions? Like, well, how do I just go in and talk about my week, my day, my troubles? That is something that I think just popped in my head. Like, how does that part work? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to come out of therapy feeling not always fulfilled, but at least that I'm going in the right direction as to the to deal with the problems that I have more so? Because I feel like I can just go in, tell you I had a really difficult week, and it's like, that week we'll just talk about that problem. But then I think there's something more underlying, and how am I ever going to get to that?
Right. In addition to the degrees I was talking about earlier, there's also theoretical orientations that differ by therapist, right? So cognitive behavioral therapy, there's psychodynamics, psychoanalytic therapy, interpersonal therapy, humanistic psychology. There's different ways in which people orient themselves as a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And so how it develops, how it moves forward, how it feels can be different based off of the person's orientation and style of doing therapy, right? So I can respond to my style of doing therapy. Mm-hmm. I was trained from more of a psychodynamic background. I currently have a lot of influences that are psychoanalytic. I work with a consultant who gives me feedback on my cases because I think it's very important for me to get that feedback at all times to make my work more stable and solid and stay ethical, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, the sessions go wherever the client wants to go, right? What is top of mind for them? What comes up for them? I think what comes up is what they probably needed to bring up. Right. They might have a lot of things that are deeper or things that are from far away back when, but if that's not coming up in the session, I still think it's related because it's still coming up and is important for them to bring up in their safe space. Right. Something about that brought that up for them. And people say, well, how do I know I'm feeling better? Or how do I know was this a good enough session? And I think my question back would be, why wasn't this good enough? And what is making it uncomfortable if it doesn't feel quote unquote productive? What is the message you have on what productivity is supposed to look like, right? Is it okay for us to be uncomfortable with things not having solutions by the end of a session, right? Have we been trained to come up with solutions so we feel better and we tie it all up? Yeah. Or we get an A on the exam and then we're happy and we move on to the next chapter.
It's like checking the box.
Right, because I think that is something I've noticed as a part of also being for many people, a high achieving individual, is we got to be productive. We got to keep moving. We got to make this worth our money.
Yeah.
So yeah. Is it okay for the process to be slower? And I think it is slower personally when the work is deeper. It does go slower sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up productivity. Raksha and I have had conversations with our parents on this podcast to kind of explore what their journey was, you know, getting to Zambia from India, you know, all the factors that led to them moving, and also kind of connecting our story with theirs, because, you know, we're obviously more intimately familiar with our journey being in Zambia and then forward from there. But kind of having a sense of connecting those multi-generational narratives into one piece. Mm-hmm. But in doing that exercise, we felt like it was challenging to get our parents to open up about certain things. And the concept of productivity that you'd mentioned, it kind of just piqued my interest a little bit, because I can totally hear my mom or Raksha's dad saying, you know, like, what's the point of exploring that further? Like, it's probably just going to get you to an answer that you don't like. And then there you are, that's the answer. And then what, you know? So sometimes it's almost better off to look at the past as, yeah, that was challenging, but we are beyond that challenge now. And so we don't really need to go too deep into that, because what's the point?
And I think that speaks to, again, why therapy is not the norm in our community, right? Mm-hmm. Because not everyone, but many of us, our families carry intergenerational trauma with them. Mm-hmm. And the way they coped with that trauma of leaving their families, leaving their homes, leaving what they knew, being scared in a new country, being afraid of losing connection to their families of, or, you know, country of origin, whatever might be the case, right? These huge, scary steps, I think, in addition to maybe losing people, never being able to say goodbye to them, right? Many times people are taught, don't talk about it because it'll make you feel worse. Mm-hmm. Right? Or don't talk about it because we have to move forward. And if we don't move forward, we will not be able to get up. And so if some communities have been taught, this is how we cope, they're not going to want to maybe, you know, meet us where we are at here, the three of us talking about let's get into it and talk about all the deepest, darkest, hardest parts of your journey, right? Because they've learned to cope. We move forward, stay silent, don't give it language. Mm-hmm. And many times they were never taught a language, right? Many of our parents and grandparents, if they made these journeys, they're pretty young.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. They might have also not been taught a language, because if they did, it would sound ungrateful, or they would look like they're not strong enough. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think all these narratives, family narratives, come up. And so it can be really uncomfortable when we're trying to dig into their stories, because we have a different orientation or idea to what feelings mean and stories mean and narratives mean.
How do we go about changing that narrative or that approach to mental health and seeking therapy in our communities? Mm-hmm. You know, do we just have more conversations about it? Do we force the issue? Do we kind of, especially for us who are, you know, far away from our parents and from our extended families, it feels like it's a lot more difficult to have these conversations because we barely have any FaceTime with our loved ones. So all of that time is focused on, you know, updating them on the day and updating them on the good stuff, but not really kind of pushing and prodding. But, you know, besides just immigrants like myself and Raksha, who a lot of our family and friends are, you know, in a different place from us, but generally as a South Asian community or an immigrant community, how do we change this narrative?
Something to keep in mind is that while we might want to have these really big conversations and important conversations, it might not go the way we want it to, right? And there might be some grief around that, and that's okay. Mm. And by grief, I mean sadness that it didn't get as deep as we wanted it to, or we were shut down, or they said something insensitive. I think that is something we have to sort of grieve within us and with our peers when there is maybe a wall that we hit. If we don't hit the wall, I mean, that's great. That's awesome. I know some people have that relationship now. I've just spoke with someone this past week, and he said that now as he's getting older, he's finding himself have better conversations with his parents because now, you know, he's already a parent himself and there's just a lot less cost to having these conversations in terms of like what it means for their relationship, right? In terms of no one's going to break up with him. They just know, okay, we talk about it and we have dinner the next day again, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it can happen. But like what we were talking about earlier, it might not be immediate. It might be slow, mm-hmm. right? It might be in baby steps. I think what's cool is there are articles now, there's media, images, representation, different ways in which the community is talking about it. And so it might have to be in little snippets, sending articles to each other if you're living from far apart from each other, reading the same book together to say, like, what do you think about this book? Mm-hmm, right. I remember reading years ago one of the Jhumpa Lahiri books, and my dad read it too, and he's picked up certain pieces of it that I had not picked up. And I realized, wow, I was identifying with the daughter and he totally identified with the dad. I felt validated and, you know, seen by this author in this book. And he felt really sad that he might be the old dad in one of the stories. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think there are ways in which we can start having conversations, even if we're far apart from our families, in these ways through engaging with other material if we need to. But also, I think it might be important to make sure it's consistent and to allow for discomfort, allow for the good updates and the tough updates, right? And it, some people will say, well, I'll talk about it when I see them next. I'm like, okay, you might see them a year from now.
Right.
Maybe it's important to just have the conversation you want to now and know that it might not be perfect. It might not be smooth, but it's still an important one to have. And I think too, for people who are trying to have the conversation with you, what we can do, what you can do, what you, all of us can do is making sure that we don't say things that continue this cycle of minimizing mental health issues. And by that, I mean, making sure we're not the ones doing what we've heard. Things like,
right.
Oh, just shake it off.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be fine, man. It's okay. You know, it's just a one-off thing. It happens, right?
Yeah.
Making sure that catching ourselves to break that generational cycle, right, of dismissing tough stuff.
Yeah. I love that. I love that because I think personally, I can speak for myself. If my younger siblings come to me and say they're having a tough time, the first thing I say is, you'll be fine. Get over it. Like, it's not such a big deal. It'll be so much more to come to life. Trust me, this is such a small hurdle. Right. But I'm catching myself more now because they're down telling me stop invalidating my feelings. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly toxic positivity is thrown around. And mm-hmm. I'm like, we didn't grow up hearing all these things. We were told to get on with it. Mm-hmm. And suddenly these kids are pushing back and it's making me reconsider how I should be talking or things that I should be doing, knowing that in the future, if I'm going to be a mom, I shouldn't be invalidating my own child because maybe did I get invalidated when I was a kid? You know, you start thinking about all of those things because you really want to break the cycle. So what you said just made me really, again, once more smile through the whole thing.
Yeah. And I think, Raksha, like you mentioned, right, it feels like for us, we've had it good. So the instinct is kind of always to be like, how we grew up couldn't have been too bad. And there's not really a lot to change. You know, that's kind of what we would want to emulate with our own kids. But we really need to keep fighting that instinct. And for you, at least you've got younger siblings. Like, I'm the youngest, so there's no one to really push back on me yet. But it feels like your siblings kind of gave us the language to use as well. Because we kind of maybe understood it as a concept, but even then it doesn't really sit in until they give it a label. And you're like, okay, that makes sense. I should stop doing that. That's something I can now look out for because I know what it's called and I know what it looks like.
They're training me now, you know, and they're actually opening up a bigger door for me to now speak my feelings and say what I feel because previously it wasn't allowed or I didn't know how to do it. So it's nice to know that the younger generation is pushing back and saying what they feel, at least from my experience.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that the future it's going to get better.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, you might not have younger siblings, but I do wonder, right? You're probably going to have in your lifetime or you already have had, or maybe even after this podcast, right? People saying things or asking you questions. And I think where this is the opportunity for you, right? To say, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but let me send you a name of a website that I heard about that helps you set up with a therapist.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I think a lot of us, I've noticed a lot of people who are really tied to our community sometimes want to be the end all be all support system for our parents, family, sisters, cousins, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to say, I don't know how rough it is for you. I can't say I understand how this feels, but I will say that I do know there are therapists and professionals who can help you better than I can. Here's a name. Here's a podcast or here's the referral I have for you, right? Because that doesn't put the burden on you to have to solve everyone's problem.
Right.
But also allows you not to dismiss someone's feelings. It just says, you know, like, here's a person that's directing you to the right people. I think that can be really powerful too, to change a narrative in the community.
That's a really good point, because I think some of the pressures, maybe not being as a guy, but just in a relationship, it feels like your partner has to be the person that fills everything. And so when something comes up that you feel like you're not equipped to deal with, it almost becomes hurtful to say, hey, like, why don't you go see someone else and talk about this? But, you know, there's instincts on both sides. I want to be the guy that can, you know, be it all for you. But at the same time, there's also that pushback to be like, why can't you be the guy that's everything for me, you know? And so I think that would probably be the same in other relationships too, with parents, with siblings, with friends.
I think these are the ways, like the question was, right? How do we make shifts in our community? I think these are the ways to not dismiss, to allow us to get supports from outside of our homes and our families, recognizing that no family has it all at all times, and noticing when we need to get more supports to be healthier as families, parents, individuals, partners, wives, right? Whatever might be the case, that we all need a team. And to assume toxic positivity or assume the stance of don't tell anybody what other people think or what's wrong with you, right, is just going to perpetuate this shame in our community around talking about stress, pain, hurt, sadness, cross-cultural feelings, right, that need to be worked through.
I think that's a really good way to conclude it. It feels like the answer to the question of what can we do as a community seems to be the answer to a question of why seek mental help and how do you kind of go through that. You try it, you try to kind of keep learning, and you try to be consistent with it. You try to make sure you're understanding the language, you're understanding, you know, the questions you have and the answers that are out there. It feels like there's no definite, like, oh, you need to hit these check boxes in order to feel like you have gotten the best out of therapy. Oh, you need to hit all these check boxes to feel like, okay, I've done my part in facilitating these kinds of conversations. It's more so just continually learning and continually kind of putting yourself out there to learn more.
And if it doesn't work ever with a therapist, it's okay to tell them and to find a better fit for you. That's okay. You're not a bad kid, bad person for doing that.
With that, thank you so much, Shanta. This has been a really enlightening conversation. As Raksha and I said in the middle of doing one of the breaks, we have so many questions and it feels like this is so insightful. And although Raksha and I aren't necessarily shy about talking about mental health with each other, it feels like there's only so much we can kind of address ourselves and kind of learn ourselves. So it's really helpful to have your perspective and your time to answer all these questions and give us a bit more clarity on mental health in general, the services that can be provided, the situations to kind of seek that help, but also how it fits into our South Asian immigrant context. So thank you so much for your time. It's been an immense pleasure.
Thank you for this space. Really appreciate what you both are doing.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation, folks. You can find Dr. K through her website, snktherapy.com. Find us on twosuitcasespod.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for unpacking with us.